this began, the way you might begin some marketing project with sort of dots on a map. I'd go somewhere, read something, see something, and locate it in space. And gradually, over quite a few years, it was evident to me that the dots of interesting activity actually in this center of the Eurasian landmass defined a very specific area. It is not the area that the Soviets termed Central Asia. It definitely includes Afghanistan. It definitely includes Xinjiang. And it definitely includes Khorasan, the easternmost province of Iran. And indeed, Khorasan, the heart of it is Turkmenistan and western Afghanistan, plus a few areas in Iran with Nishapur, Tus, and so forth. In other words, a bigger area emerged, not by me imposing it on a map, but just by looking at the deeds, the developments that were noteworthy. And taking that bigger area, I started thinking, well, list of who are the people who were active in this great region over these key centuries. And something absolutely struck me. Like all of you, wherever you went to high school, I learned that there was the classical period, and that the Greeks and Romans at a certain point got a little tired, and running down the field, they sort of lateral the ball over to the Arabs. The Arabs pick it up. They go down the field and for a few centuries, and then they get tired and lateral back to the Europeans, and you have the Renaissance. This, didn't you all hear this in school? It's wrong. If you go down the list of great figures that are detailed in this book, you will see that most of the big fish to whom that lateral was made were, in fact, ethnically not Arabs. They were either of various diverse Persianate ethnicities or Turkic, and they were certainly Central Asian. Now, I'm not denying that there were great Arab thinkers, people like the inventor, the great pioneer student of vision, Haitham, and there were many. But there weren't among the philosophers early, not among the big thinkers, not among the big scientists. They came later. And so when you have the 13th, 14th, 15th century, yes, by then they are more active, but they're basically writing footnotes on the great works that were written during the period that I'm describing. Now, interestingly also, this is not Persia. Geographically, it's not Persia. In fact, it is the heart of ancient Persian culture, as it is the heart of ancient Turkic culture. But it is not, in any sense, concomitant with the modern state of Iran. On the Turkic side, great pioneering work of the Turkic languages was written by a guy basically from Kyrgyzstan. And what did he do? He wrote a book in which he told, sort of nervy, he basically told everyone in the world, shape up, now you've got to learn Turkish. And you can't avoid it, we're the big comers here. And he explained Turkic grammar and morphology and everything. And not only did he give you instructions, teach yourself Turkic, but he also then went into about 8 or 10 different Turkic dialects and explain what are the changes and adaptations you have to make if you've learned this one and you now want to learn this one. And he appended to this, just for the heck of it, a map in which the earliest representation of Japan known exists. So we're talking about a very curious area of intensive interaction of peoples, just as Kent Calder said. They are surrounded by everyone. They are the only ones in touch with everyone. Chinese, we hear all this talk about the Silk Road, and I claim certain guilt about this. The Chinese had a curious habit. As the great Joseph Needham pointed out, they tended to bring their goods to the border and say, okay, guys, pay up and take them. They didn't take the goods to Central Asia, the Middle East, and so on. The Indians did. And indeed, the relation of India, Indian subcontinent, to Central Asia is one of the really important factors in this book with great implications for the present. Grant Smith, who grew up in India and knows it better than all of us, it wouldn't be surprised at this because he's also a Persianist. And these relationships don't surprise people with that kind of background. But the Indian, Chinese, and then Middle Eastern, both Christian and Muslim, relationship, these were all filtered through this one place. And so you get amazing things like paper. We all know paper was invented by China. The Chinese paper, however, you wouldn't use, excuse me, for toilet paper. It was made of mulberry leaves and other weird bamboo, and it was totally absorbent. It wasn't, couldn't write on it. It crunchy stuff. The Central Asians, just like the Japanese after the war, looked at this and said, it's a pretty good idea. They really haven't developed it right. They said, well, we have all this cotton fiber. Why don't we try it with that? They made the paper, the only paper that worked. And as a result, you go to any medieval archive, cathedral archive in the West or in the Middle East, and you will find that the best documents are all written on Samarkand paper. So this happened over and over. They were the mediators. Everything passed through them. Ideas as well. No other place on the earth was like this, with mediating all different cultures. I don't go into this, I won't today, but one of the peculiar defining things about this greater Central Asia is the depth of its cultural and economic history. I was just in Pakistan. I visited a site where in the 2nd century AD, on an area about the distance from here up to Brookings, were on one street a Buddhist stupa, a Hindu shrine, a Zoroastrian temple, and a Jain temple, and finally a Christian church founded by St. Thomas. And they were all, we know, they all existed simultaneously. So a degree of pluralism with all this coming in from all sides. You see the picture of Buddha here. Where does Buddha come from? He's obviously coming from India, but his remains are moved to the edge of Central Asia near Peshawar, and there they meet up with Greeks who from post-Alexander, and these Greek sculptors say, you know, we could do a better Buddha if you do some nice folds in his, you know, and so the image of Buddha that went to the East was an invention of Central Asia. And I argue the same is true theologically, too. I go into that in some detail. In other words, location is really important. Now, it's not just location. It's trade. And we have some very good economists in the room who really know about trade. And these people were trading with everyone. As a result, you have Samanid dirhams that were coins, silver coins, that were minted in what is now Uzbekistan and Afghanistan, turning up as obviously widely used currencies for international exchange in Sweden and in Sri Lanka. The same. If you go to the airport outside Stockholm, about 5 miles away is a place where they found a whole hoard of Central Asian coins. Same in Sri Lanka. The museum in Sri Lanka has hordes of Central Asian coins. So they were serious as traders, and that meant that they had to have bills of exchange. They had to make all sorts of mathematical calculations. All kinds of written documents and records for this kind of trade to work, and they were the masters. They were at the center of the web. Now, let me say a word about the achievements. Let me just give two, I think, kind of nifty examples. One has to do with Columbus. Christopher Columbus was peddling his project to sail to the Indies. And he was looking for investors. He literally had to go and appear before investors and convince them that they should buy three ships and entrust them to him. And the debate turned on how far is it from here to there. And Columbus, Columbus, in fact, dug out a Latin translation of a book by an astronomer named Fargani, meaning he's from the Fergana Valley, Uzbekistan, or Tajikistan, up there somewhere. Fargani's book has an inaccurate calculation of the diameter of the world, but it's not that inaccurate. And of course, he assumed it was round. Columbus took that figure and made a mistake. Whether deliberately or not, we don't know. He basically said that Fargani says that the circumference of the world is such and such, therefore, we should assume that if I sail so many days, we will be in India. His mistake was that Fargani used Arab miles, and Columbus thought he was talking about Roman miles. Made him off by a third, which moved. That's why he truly thought when he got to the West Indies that he was dealing with India. So it was had he only gotten his Fargani right, he would never have set sail. Now, another guy who had who looked at Fargani was the greatest genius, I would argue, between classical antiquity, between the Ptolemaic age and Hellenistic Egypt and the Renaissance, and the equal, fully the equal of anyone in the Renaissance, was Biruni. Biruni, born in the territory of present-day Uzbekistan, he lived in Turkmenistan, briefly in Iran, but basically he was then kidnapped by a rather nasty ruler in Afghanistan, goes down there and spends 30 years in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Now, Biruni had three great passions in life. He had so many, you can't count them. Three that are relevant here. One was he was interested in specific gravity. He invented the concept of specific gravity, measured the specific gravity of all sorts of minerals to the third decimal point, and no one's improved on it. Second, he was interested in longitude and latitude. The Greeks had figured out how to measure both, but he had figured out much better ways of doing it, and he was a collector of longitude. If you were traveling with Biruni, you get to some town and you say, okay, stop, we're going to calculate the longitude and latitude. And he had 600 of them. And then his third great passion was measuring the circumference of the Earth. He thought Fargani was just primitive. And one day, he found himself about 30 miles northeast of Islamabad at a castle. He was there for the summer, it was cool, and he was heading back to Ghazni in Afghanistan where he lived. And he had no equipment except an astrolabe. But with this, and some very, very interesting new techniques, he measured the diameter circumference of the Earth to within 12 miles. No one got closer till the end of the 17th century, early 18th century. Now, he took this bag of notes back to Ghazni, sits down at a table, and makes a new map, whether he used a globe or a map, I don't know, and immediately he puts all his longitudes and latitudes on it. And he notices something. Wait a minute. If this is the circumference, and the westernmost longitude is somewhere in West Africa or Europe, and the easternmost is China or Japan, he said, that only covers two-fifths of the globe. Being a rational guy, he then asked, well, what's in the other three-fifths? And he's proceeding absolutely rationally. He says, well, we can hypothesize that it's all water. He said, on the other hand, water's specific gravity is very low compared to what most continents are made of. He said, that will create balance problems, and we don't have a hypothesis that could explain that. He said, therefore, we must assume that there are other land masses somewhere out there. And he then said, well, now, are they inhabitable? And he said, well, here is where our northernmost latitude is in the Eurasian landmass that we know, and here's the southernmost one in Africa somewhere, southern India. He said, we have to assume that if these unknown landmasses out in the middle of the ocean are uninhabitable, they must be either north of that north latitude or south of the south latitude. He said, we have no hypothesis that would explain why nature would squish these continents north there and south there when we see Eurasian landmass is spread around the circumference of the globe. Why shouldn't the same process, we must therefore assume that similar processes were at work in the rest of the globe. He's just using, by the way, classical Aristotelian logic. And very rigorously. And he therefore concludes in a Codex Masudicus, which is yet to be translated into English, by the way. It's one bad 19th century translation, but it's available in German, it's available in French, and partly in Russian. In this Codex Masudicus, he describes all this and says, well, we must therefore conclude that somewhere between the Atlantic and Pacific, there are one or more major continents and they are inhabitable. Period. That's 1020 AD. That's the quality of mind that we're dealing with. Now, consider that the same guy made similar contributions to 10 other fields. These were all polymaths, really big fish. We know Avicenna, you know, Ibn Sina, whose codex of canon of medicine really created Western medicine. It also created Eastern medicine. There is still to this day a Unani medicine in India, which is meaning Greek medicine, which is what they got from Ibn Sina. This guy was obnoxious. He was vain, difficult, hard to deal with, and lived an absolutely chaotic life, but churned out book after book on major topics, including theology, including philosophy, and a formidable figure. I could go on. The list is enormous. And these are all the guys that we thought were the Arabs to whom the ancients past the lateral. My point here is that there was a major release of intellectual energy. And it's worth asking, you know, the English edition of this book, the publisher called the other day and said, well, shouldn't we call this the golden age of Islamic science? I said, well, how do you account for the Christians among them? Or the ones who were totally indifferent to religion. or the ones who were really sort of crypto Zoroastrians. It's very interesting. It was only about by the 12th century that you really have an overwhelmingly Muslim population in this region. Up to that point, you have great diversity. At a place like Konya Urgench, which is Gurganj, one of the great cities of the region in northern Turkmenistan, right across the border from Uzbekistan, there, for about 15 years, you had the greatest concentration of minds on the planet. Of them, there were two or three Christians. There were five or seven, including both Biruni and Avicenna, Muslims, both Shia and Sunni, and so on. And you had a Zoroastrian or two. So it was a highly diverse intellectual environment. And it was intimately connected with the worldliness of all this trade. But in addition to the trade, there's one other factor that I think has to be mentioned. And that is, this is a water-starved region. And all these people lived in cities. This is not, you know, Poets in the Landscape, the great, great book by Gilbert Hyatt on the Roman poets. You know, no, these are real urban people, and they are living real urban lives. And these urban centers that are the heart of what I'm talking about, they were all oases, and they were irrigated, and they had the most extraordinarily sophisticated systems of irrigation. In one city alone, we have a 12th century report that says they had 10,000 people working on the irrigation system. They had divers. They had people who could, you know, do everything, highly specialized. This, just having that kind of an economy, when Kent speaks of intensive, you know, the Soviets, when they wanted to increase production, they just threw in more land. When these guys wanted to increase production, they couldn't just throw in more land. They had to irrigate better. They had to be smarter, wiser. And this discipline of an irrigation culture, hydraulic culture, if you will, is an important factor. And to the extent that the Mongols did destroy this, about which more in a minute, I would say they did in one sense. They destroyed the economic underpinnings by systematically going at the irrigation systems. Once they had, A, killed off a lot of the population that could have rebuilt the irrigation system, but then destroyed these complex irrigation systems, there was no way these people could come back. Now, what happened to all this? Let me end with this. Kent alluded to my last chapter, and you know, when I started writing it, I truly didn't have any glib ideas. I knew one thing, and that is the real intellectual burst was over before the Mongols. It's not to say that there were serious people. I described them all in great detail. People like Tusi, the great astronomer, Persian astronomer, Central Asian, Tusi couple, and so on. If you know anything about astronomy, and there were others. There was Uluk Bey and Samarkand, who really, even though the poor guy was trying to run an empire that he'd been bequeathed by his father, he nonetheless was a first-class astronomer and a even higher class educator who started real colleges and universities where they taught science, really so. They called them madrasas, but they weren't at all. This was modern learning. It didn't outlast his lifetime, by the way. But you had, post-Mongols, a few of the old-type geniuses, but very few. This was done before the Mongols. Was it the Portuguese sailors who learned how to go around? No. Mm-hmm. You have to ask yourself, why in the heck would some guy in Portugal be playing around with a new kind of tiller and new kinds of sails so he could go all the way around Africa. I mean, is he crazy? Is he nothing else to occupy his days? No. They were doing that because they had heard that the old land routes across Asia, through Central Asia, were A, too expensive, and B, too dangerous. So high tariffs and low security killed it. But even before that, it was over. And here's something which will probably get me in a bit of trouble in some quarters, but it seems to me that the real intellectual dampening that occurred actually took place a century before the Mongol invasion. And the person who was most associated with it was a extraordinarily interesting, bright, sassy theologian and general thinker by the name of Ghazali. Now, I go into great detail in the religious history about this. And I argue in the book that because this was the region where Zoroastrianism, which is in a sense the father of all the great religions, with its first concept of heaven and hell and redemption and so on and so on, Zoroastrianism is at home here. We know geographically all the references in the Avesta are Central Asian references. Whether or not Zoroaster preached in Balkh or not in Afghanistan, we don't know for sure, but there's no question it's a Central Asian phenomenon. You also have it as the great center of Buddhism for seven centuries. And the more we're learning about that, the more we're learning of the continuity of Buddhism in this region. So you have, in the case of the Zoroastrians, these are the people that codify it, write it all up. And in the case of Buddhism, it's these scholars sitting at hundreds of monasteries in Afghanistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, even in Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan. They are the ones who are codifying and editing the great works of Buddhism that then get sent off to the East. And most of the translators of Buddhist texts into Chinese are Central Asians. We know them by name, 27 of them. Now, that's the atmosphere. These people were not, with the advent of Islam, they just turned these editorial skills on that. And very quickly arose the idea of, well, we have the text of the Quran, and as you know, one of the early Umayyad caliphs said, well, let's get an authoritative text, and we won't go into the great debates about that, but that was done. Then they wanted to answers to a lot of the other practical daily life questions. And so they said, well, maybe we could collect the sayings of the prophet that have come down through various ways, and let's get an authoritative collection of these, hadiths, as they're called. And hadith collecting, became a huge passion for about 150 years. And overwhelmingly, the most enthusiastic and the best collectors of the hadiths, of the sayings of the prophet, were Central Asians. Of the eight authoritative texts of hadiths, I think something five or six are by Central Asians. This is the same tradition that they had been practicing as Zoroastrians and Buddhists were the editors. And Bukhari's edition is considered the second most holy book of Islam from Bukhara. He was an orphan. He was looking for a sort of principle of authority. His family had some money. He was able to spend 20 years collecting them, going around, talking to people, and so on. So this is the background. In the looking for certainty, we want textual guidance for every decision in life, versus the rationalists, the intellectuals, who are saying, no, 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 don't worry, you can trust reason to come up with good answers to things too. So this conflict really began early and really ended in a disaster. A key moment occurred in Baghdad. You know the Abbasid caliphs, beginning in around 750 AD. These were all guys whose power base was Central Asia. Central Asians took over the caliphate, in reality. They were completely dependent upon Central Asian Turkic soldiers. Half of their intellectual elite were from Central Asia. And the caliphs themselves, although ethnically Arab, their power base had been in Merv and in Nishapur and Khorasan, not in the Arab world. So one of these nerviest of these caliphs, who was right out of what is now Turkmenistan, a guy named Mamun, he launches an inquisition. But he's on the side of the rationalists, the intellectuals. And he calls in every religious person, all the, you know, of the officialdom, and gives them a test. He's really obnoxious. And a lot of the orthodox and traditionalists stood up to him. I mean, this was as bad an inquisition, but it was in the name of reason. You see, this immediately started a polarization between the two camps. By the late 11th century, appeared this man, Ghazali. Now, Ghazali was smart as hell. I mean, you read him and you say, this guy's got it. He became a young professor. He got tenure early at the first madrasa. The madrasas were invented to inculcate orthodoxy, to inculcate Sunni orthodoxy. This was a Seljuk Turkic device, and he was named head of the newest and biggest madrasa. And he was a smart young guy in his 30s, and he gave lectures we know that were attended by 300 and 400 people, and he spent his days denouncing reason, denouncing the intellectuals. And it must have been great for a student body that really didn't want to read these difficult texts. But then one fine day, his patron, also a Central Asian, who was the vizier, was murdered. And then the Seljuk ruler, who had been in charge of the whole thing, died. So suddenly, Ghazali lost his support 100%. He announced that he had a great illness. He had a nervous breakdown, and emerged about 3 years later. He walks out on his family. He gets a wool robe and goes forth as a Sufi. And the rest of his life, he's now Mr. Modesty. And by the way, he writes wonderful things on faith at this period. And Thomas Aquinas revered him for these writings, and rightly so. They're wonderful. But this was the guy whose attacks at Baghdad against reason, against science, against learning, against open inquiry, they were savage and relentless. And I submit that from that moment on, which was occasioned by the Sunni-Shia conflict, that from that moment on, two bright people meeting in the street of any nominally Muslim city would immediately be checking each other out to see, is he with us or against us? This created a very, very hostile environment in which the intellectual endeavor was eternally on the defensive. That's my hypothesis. Maybe it's unfair, but you leave it to you to look into it. Well, let me conclude with a very quick note. I say nothing about the contemporary implications of all this, deliberately. It's going to be translated into a number of languages within the region. I'll let them duke it out, and I'm sure they'll all find problems with what I've written. But it seems to me this is a legitimate subject of inquiry. I mean, what does it mean to have had this kind of a heritage? If you're an Uzbek today, if you're a Tajik today, if you're a Turkmen today, why, there's a park in the center of Ashgabat, and in it are huge statues, 12 feet high, of all the people I'm writing about. You know, and I went there, I saw it, and so I asked one of the very senior officials in the government, I said, you know, these are great, great people, but, you know, they're not Turkmen. this guy's from Uzbekistan, this guy's from Tajikistan, this guy's from Afghanistan. I got an extremely interesting answer. He said, that's true, but we share a common culture. They're ours. Now, I don't know, you know, whether such a consciousness is going to prevail in the long run. But we had a remarkable talk here last spring by a professor from Hofstra University, Professor Nymark, about the Sogdians. Some of you may have been here. The Sogdians were these people who lived all over this region and had their own language. And his argument was that, yes, there was at one point a true regional sensibility and maybe consciousness of this common heritage, and it is a common heritage, may help reconstruct it without dismantling or weakening sovereignties. Who knows? But these are interesting questions. Let me conclude with this. I hope this provides some kind of introduction.
And I hope we can have some good questions. Fred, I have one question that you touch on in various places in the book. The role of language in making this possible, and did it have a role in the end?
Most of what I'm talking about, most of the texts were written in Arabic. A Japanese who writes a book in English doesn't become an Englishman. A Central Asian writing in Arabic isn't an Arab. But Arabic, like Latin in the West, for a few key centuries, provided a lingua franca. And very interestingly, there have been several interesting studies on this, the existence of Central Asians and the Persianate languages, the Turkic languages, they had an immense influence on the development of Arabic as a flexible literary and scientific tool. This continued, of course, quite late, and certainly it is an essential element. The translations of classical literature, science, philosophy, so on, Aristotle, Archimedes, everyone, all these were mainly into Arabic. There were some into Persian. They were done mainly, by the way, by Christian translators in Syria. But unquestionably, the existence of this lingua franca facilitated what I'm talking about.
And did it, towards the end of the period, did it begin to decline as modern Persian came up, as you had Turkic rule?
Yeah, it does. But something else happens. And I go into this when I talk about Tamerlane's heirs. You know, you see these extraordinary buildings and artistic works and manuscripts of the Timurid era. And you think, wow, this is unbelievable. But very interestingly, by that point, they are making the most elegant, beautiful copies of these great texts from my guys, the earlier ones. But they are viewing them now as complete. These are closed documents. They aren't something to study and, well, did he have this right? Should we correct it that way? No, this was frozen by then. And so my conclusion is that after the intellectual effervescence ended, there was an aesthetic effervescence. Their arts were always extremely important. I barely mentioned this, but the greatest thinker, analyst, theoretician on music before modern times was from present day Kazakhstan, Farabi. He wrote a wonderful book on theory of music and was a pretty good player himself. But the fact is that even though the aesthetic dimension was very, very highly developed during this golden age, what happened afterwards was the intellectual life sapped away, but the aesthetic life absolutely continued to flourish. And there's an interesting question. I suggest that, you know, you have these three great follow-on empires, all of them Turkic. You have the Ottomans, you have the Safavids in Iran, initially Turkic, and you have the Mughals in India, who are from the Fergana Valley of Uzbekistan. Why didn't any of them really take off? It's a very interesting question. Is it related to what I'm talking about? And my conclusion is that, you know, they were not interested in new knowledge. They all rejected printing. You know, it took them 200, 300 years to take up printing. And, you know, had printing been taken up in my era, the golden age, yeah, these people were vultures. They would have been all over it, like they were over every new invention. But by the time printing came along to these later empires, we're complete, we're powerful, don't mess with us, we don't need it.
We have a question down here.
Fred, thank you for sharing and writing your book.
Could you identify yourself?
Yes, I will. I'm Dr. Sam Hancock of Emerald Planet and Emerald Planet TV. And Fred, thank you for doing all this and sharing your knowledge. But looking at this kind of the end time, you will, the decline when they were railing against rational thought and kind of wanting to do away with the open debates that were going on at that time. Concomitant to that was a general decline in the economy, which would have accelerated the decline of the societies or somewhat hampered their ability to continue to expand and bring in new ideas, new thought, new people.
Well, that's... Would you accept the possibility that maybe the economies continued to hum along for a while after the intellectual peak had been reached? Because I think that's what happened. And there were powerful states still. But you know, here's another dimension. Was this all a matter of patronage? You know, you could be the most blockheaded butcher, brute, as a leader, but there was... For this period, the presumption that you were going to make yourself look good by hiring some smart people and creative people to come to your court and sit around, and that I go into this at one point, that sitting around was their major activity. But, you know, you'd hire poets. I mean, Sanjar and Seljuk, who ruled in Merv, Sanjar, in whose tomb you can see today, Sanjar had 300 poets. You know, a couple of them were really good. I haven't gone into all this, but you know, there, this doesn't yield to simple explanations. I mean, I am astonished, for example. Take the poet Rudaki. Rudaki was born in Tajikistan. He flourished at the court in Bukhara. He returned in Uzbekistan. He returned in old age, having been basically chucked out by his rulers to his home village. This guy, he was a pop star. You know, you can't explain it through wealth or something like that. If you read his poetry today, and there's a guy up at Boston who's done the most gorgeous translations, you read it and you say, I know this guy. You know, it's not so simple to explain the phenomenon of a Rudaki. A Ferdowsi, this guy from a place called Tus in the border of Afghanistan and Iran on the Iranian side. Ferdowsi, he is some young guy who gets a research assistantship with the local ruler who is appointed from Bukhara, and this guy, who is a bit of a schismatic religiously, decides that he is going to collect and issue every tradition, every national folk epic of the Persian peoples. And he gets teams of people gathering this stuff, and then one by one, all the leaders of them die off, and this young guy, Ferdowsi, is faced with an existential question. He said, boy, I could have this gig. You know, this could be mine. But it's going to be a lot of work. He makes a commitment at a very young age, and I think his late 20s, early 30s. Takes him decades and decades and decades to do it, but he writes up the Shahnameh. And he does his writing in his home in Tus. He then gets patronized by a real monster, this Mahmud of Ghazni, the same guy I was talking about earlier. He never gets paid. He you know, the terrible stories about this. And yet he persists with basically no support over a generation and a half and produces a work of huge genius. Now, you can't explain this by any of the easy sociological lines that we use. And by the way, if you've never read Ferdowsi, there is a translation by a guy at the University of Oklahoma named Dick Davis. And the guy's a genius as a translator. You read it and you'll say, oh, I understand why this is good stuff. But there are so many people, when you move from the general to the specific and ask, how did it happen that a guy from Hojand in Tajikistan, right on the Tajik-Uzbek border, on the western end of the Fergana Valley, how did it happen that Hojandi became the greatest inventor of astronomical equipment in history? You know, these don't yield to glib explanations. That's really where I come down. I just am left in awe of people taking any subject and pushing it to the hilt the way so many people did then.
I think there are some questions over down in the front row and then back there.
Thanks. Alex Peterson from the Woodrow Wilson Center. Thanks, Fred, for your fascinating talk. Your book begins with essentially the date of the Battle of Talas. I'm assuming 750 or so. What, and Dr. Calder mentioned the Tang having been there beforehand, While it may not be much, did you find any legacy, any leftovers, if you will, in this intellectual flowering from the Chinese influence? Thanks.
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. When I was a student at Cambridge in England, I remember eating lunch or dinner several times at Clare College, where the great Needham, who wrote 25 volumes on the history of science and in China, unbelievable work. It reads like a novel. If you've never looked in Needham, you cheated yourself. The guy was a phenomenal writer. Every topic on earth enters into his book. But you know, in the end of the day, Chinese learning had practically no influence. I mean, yes, they were there. They were being influenced by Central Asia mightily with all the Buddhism and so on and so on. And then later, under the Mongols, Central Asia basically ran the empire in Beijing. I mean, they were all over the place. Just as they were all over the place in Baghdad, you know, or when the Western Mongols and the so-called Ilkhanate in Persia, they were all Central Asians who were running it. So I tend to come out pushing this the other direction. By contrast, Indian mathematics, Indian science, Indian astronomy, Indian activity in a dozen fields, the interplay with Central Asia is constant. I mean, we know about Roman numerals, Arabic numerals aren't Arabic numerals. They're Indian, and how did they get from India to the Arabs? Through guys in Khwarezm, in Western Uzbekistan. They were the big importers, you know. Negative numbers, you know. Omar Khayyam, the poet, he basically that was one of his features. He also, irrational numbers, something that the Indian mathematicians had played with. Omar Khayyam also, you know, under the influence by Indians, came up with an absolutely outrageous proposition that maybe Pythagoras's principle that parallel lines cannot meet, maybe there is. He didn't say they can, which is what Lobachevsky did in the 19th century in Kazan. He said there is no logical reason why there can't be a non-Euclidean, why there can't be a non-Euclidean geometry. Now, why did a Khayyam, if you'd asked him, he wouldn't have said, oh, I'm spend my days reading Indian science. But the fact is, Indian learning interacted in both directions much more actively with Central Asia than did China. And I would say that one of Needham's great contributions, if you're willing to read 25 volumes and footnotes, the guy's a genius, and he's a wonderful writer. He's better than 99% of our pedants. The guy could write. But Needham pointed out things like this. He said, you know, windmills. He had a page on windmills. He said they're all over China. They're all over in Holland, and, you know. So where did they come from? He said, well, they didn't come from China, and he proves why. And where did they come from? Well, they came from Western Afghanistan and Khorasan in Iran. And he nails it and shows that all windmills arose from there. So the influence of Central Asia on China is profound. And it's not just the other way.
In the back on the left, the other side.
Thank you. I'm Navbohor Imanova from the Voice of America. I'm really enjoying the presentation. You mentioned Ulugbek, who does not necessarily fall into that period that you define as the golden age.
But he's part of it.
Right. He's a part of it. And I guess the bigger question for all of us, especially for Central Asians, is what do we learn from this history? I know you don't talk much about the present times and the issues and the challenges, but anybody who reads the book is going to end up asking himself or herself, saying that, well, what happened? How did it end? And what should happen for a new age to begin? As you know, in Central Asia now, everybody has their own history books, their own interpretations, their own claims, and their own arguments. What should happen for the region to, I guess, to start another age of enlightenment?
Well, I think what you just did is what needs to happen. I mean, you first have to ask. And people are. You know, we're talking about, I mean, I think this must change the way you sit down with a person from anywhere in this region. And after reading this book, you're going to say, wait a minute, you know, you're carrying something in your cultural genes that's pretty neat. I think their history is, I hate to use the word, it's empowering. Now, that said, there is a but. And I go into this only at one point where I really work over Farabi, a great philosopher, who wrote one of the few real theoretical books on politics. And basically I say, well, you know, Farabi, that's very nice, but what a pity that the one book you guys never translated was Aristotle's Politics. And you missed the boat. And you know, on the one hand, you can say, well, wait a minute, the patronage, you could not have had what we're talking about without patronage. And royal patronage and imperial patronage and so on, often by genuine bastards, you know, was big. It was very important. On the other hand, you can say that this is a life that was quite separate from big politics, that to rule really meant to extract taxes, that in a sense all governments were simply rent seekers. If you draw a rule line on the map, where was the Samanid Empire? Where was the empire of Mahmud of Ghazni? Where was the Seljuks? Where were the, you know, you name them. It's basically the method they all used was to go and bonk their neighbor over the head and say, now look, unless you want to us to do this again, pay us so much a year. Which really, in a sense, I don't spell this out as in too great detail, but in a sense, it creates an environment in which politics, the public realm, on a big level, is simply the paying of tribute to someone, and that everything else is left to home rule. It's to your oasis, and so I'm not totally clear about this, but it seems to me one could argue from this history that if you want culture, get real local life and a real local economy and people really interacting on a local basis, Maybe you can tolerate something less than perfection on a high national or regional level if you have that intense local life. Their books, only at the end of this, I came across a 4-volume work that was published in Central Asia in about, I think, the 12th century, early 12th century. A big book. And it is full of absolute trivia. I mean, it is the sort of thing that you know, that newsstands at bus stations would have. And I was absolutely enthralled. It exists only in a sort of bizarre German translation of one volume of it. But someone on it, because you read this, and you understand how rich and tense, yeasty life was at the local level, and that this wasn't just a bunch of intellectuals sitting around and cogitating. You know, there were one of the great the codifiers of Sunni Islam lived in what is now Uzbekistan, and at a place called Margalan. And interesting, he spent his whole life in this town. And they actually found, and he described, where he lived. It's about 20 feet from the main highway. You know, this wasn't some guy off in a monastery. He was right in the thick of it. I think they all were. I think that intense urban life was more important than whatever the big political life did or didn't do to them. But they, you know, this was a generator of huge empires. I mean, we think, you know, everyone is busy. Well, who's going to control Central Asia? If I were a Central Asia, I'd say, wait, read your history. You know, what about the Mongols? What about the Seljuks? What about the Samanids? What about the, it goes on and on and on. You know, one Timurids. The some of the biggest, roughest empires, Mahmud of Ghazni on Eurasia, all came out of this region.
We go over this side to the young woman back there, and then front of her.
Working. Dr. Starr, so you work with a lot of Central Asians. You met a lot of Central Asians. Have you, writing this book, have you ever thought about why current-day Central Asians don't know that they are sons and daughters of conquerors, as Hugh Pope said, or that they are descendants of this great scientists. I mean, why we don't know about this? And the second question was second part of that was what Naubahar said. Have you ever thought about, I went through the school in Uzbekistan, elementary, middle, high school, university. And I mean, they talk about it a little bit there, but you never come out of there thinking that, oh my God, I mean, these people, they're all from my region.
I Turkic peoples in Central Asia, and I'm sure there are several in the room here, I haven't checked around, they all know their family genealogy to seven generations. Now, that may not, that suggests a kind of engagement with the deeper past that's significant. I'll give you an example. I met a guy, actually in Islamabad a few weeks ago, who is a reporter for Financial Times, and his last name is Bukhari, and he wanted to review the book for the Financial Times, and I said, fine, and I said, you obviously have some connection to this region, and he said, yeah. And the next day, he brought in a huge piece of paper, and he said, here's the proof. He said, here's 37 generations of my family back to the 7th century, and you can see we emigrated down here in around 1150 or 1200. I said, yeah, right after Ghazali threw you out. but you know, I frankly think there's just a lot more knowledge and consciousness of all this lurking in Uzbekistan, Tajikistan. I think there's just a lot more than we think. And it's not been out in the public the way it could be. But I know an Uzbek scholar granted, he does this stuff, but he came across some family papers from the 17th century, and he spent a couple of years working on them, found astonishing things. You know, I think you may be shortchanging your fellow Uzbeks and fellow Tajiks. Tajiks, my God, I mean, they are publishing right now, I think, three-volume history of Tajik philosophy. It's a wonderful piece of work, you know, and I don't know how many people are reading it, but there are real books coming out in Uzbekistan and Tajikistan. There's something happening. So I absolutely predict that in 10 years, this history is going to be part of life again. About 15 years ago, I had a conversation with the president of Uzbekistan about these things. And he made, I thought, an extremely droll comment. I said, well, do you think you people are ever going to get along together and acknowledge some common ties again? And he laughed and he said, well, you know, he said, since independence, he said, we have all become more like ourselves. In other words, everyone's gone his own way. Well, that goes for a while. Did here, you know, after independence. It took, you know, because you're protecting sovereignty, you are establishing territorial integrity, building basic institutions, you can't expect this stuff to be on the front burner in that time. But this task has been pretty successfully accomplished. And so I think you're going to see something much more real in the next period, and it's going to have a relationship to whom they to what they have been in the past.
Right there in front. No, that one back.
Wayne Murray, the American Foreign Policy Council. Fred, we've known each other a long time, so you'll forgive a slight note of skepticism. I welcome your scholarship. I welcome the book. I have a feeling that in the region, it's going to be used, at least in the near term, by governments to legitimize their own power. In the same way that somebody raised those statues in that park in Ashgabat, to claim we are the inheritors of this great culture, therefore we have the right to rule. I very much doubt that very many people in the region who are in paneled offices are going to use your scholarship to justify opening up freedom of thought, freedom of speech, freedom of inquiry. I think that's what the region needs, and I don't quite see the road to it. I do think it is very important that educated people in the region do have this sense of this cultural commonality, these cultural heritage, and things like that. But I have a feeling that scholarship, any kind of scholarship, is subject to abuse, as well as to encouraging enlightenment.
Sure.
And I have a feeling that you're going to be quoted by various chanceries and ministries in the region yes. to justify things that you would not yourself wish yeah. to justify.
Yeah, it could happen. But let me just say, a year or two ago, I was in Turkmenistan, and with about 10 minutes notice, I was asked if I would address the entire student body of the new medical university. And I walked into a hall with 800 people, and all the girls wearing national dress and all the guys in white shirts. I walk in totally unprepared, you understand. And I desperately needed a theme. And I said, I want to talk this morning about the greatest medical person from this region, Ibn Sina. Now, I warmed up by talking about Razi. Now, Razi, who in fact was from Iran, but his education was totally in Central Asia. All his students were from Central Asia, and he really is a Central Asian figure. He was a complete atheist. He was a very mischievous person. I mean, but a genius as a medical guy. I had talked about Razi, but then I settled down with Ibn Sina. I said, "Look, how old are you?" And they all gave their age. And I said, "Well, here's what Ibn Sina had done when he was your age." And I said, "You know, he didn't do this by just, you know, repeating back what his professors told them." You know, I really went wild, frankly. But on the basis, because we know an awful lot about his early days. And I said, he was willing to get into arguments on things. But he was always very, you know, based on reason and so on and so on. I gave this talk and I said, "Look, you know, I wish you all success in your medical careers, and I think you are very fortunate in this region to have a model like Ibn Sina before you." So, as I left, I said, "If any of you want to comment on this, here's my email." And, of course, how many emails are there in Turkmenistan? But actually, there are quite a lot at universities now. Over the next 6 months, if I didn't get 400 emails from Turkmenistan, I mean, it must have been at least that, saying, "I've looked into this, I've been reading about this, and yes, you know, we've got, you know." I think there's, yes, what you say is true. I mean, there's no doubt you can kidnap anything. But I think you really sell short a lot of these younger people throughout the region who are getting, you know, interested in this stuff.
The same row over.
Fred, I'm John Evans, formerly of the State Department, and my first foreign service assignment was in Iran.
Yes.
And I just wanted to say that this has been a fascinating discussion, but from the days that I spent in the Shah's Iran, most of what you said would have been just considered a given. Yes. Ferdowsi, Rudaki, Nishapur, Khorasan, all these things. And I have the feeling that because Iran here in Washington has been so much reduced to one issue of nuclear weapons, and we've been cut off from Iran for so long now, I feel that that a lot is missing. And I want to put this as a question, though. As you did research for this book, you mentioned Iran a couple of times. Did you actually get there, and were you able to talk to Iranian scholars, or is that simply too much off limits these days?
Well, let me say, my first contact with this part of the world occurred when I was 18 years old and a freshman at Yale. And I got to my room, I had a double, late in the evening, and my roommate was already in bed. And I got my stuff out and lay down, went to sleep, and from this mound of sleeping person on the next bed, I hear, just as I'm tuning out, he says, "Shabakai, good night." I said, "What the hell is that?" And it turned out that this was my roommate for several years and still a very close friend, the son of the mayor of Tehran. And he was the guy, and then I ended up going that summer and spending months and months in Turkey, learning Turkish and so on. But this roommate happens to be the uncle of our dean. Vali's father, if you know him, is here in town, and he's a serious Shia scholar. And both with him, but much more recently with quite a lot of people. There's big interest in this book. There's going to be a translation into Farsi as well as Tajik. That said, John, I think this, I mean, the Arabs are not going to like it because I'm taking all their guys away from them. But I'm not sure that in Tehran they're going to be so excited, because I basically am saying what anyone knows, that the heart and core of Persianate, if you will, culture is Central Asia. And that there it is mixed in very complex ways with many others, including Turkic, Uzbek, and so forth. I don't, you know, the old rah-rah Iran story doesn't get a lot of play in my book, even though, I mean, the whole Eastern fringe, you know, figures very prominently. One of the real heroes I come up with, and they don't know about him in Tehran because there's nothing written about him, was one of the caliphs, the Central Asians took over the caliphate, and about around 800, 820, there was a guy named Abdullah who became the ruler of Nishapur. Nishapur is a neat place. It was excavated by the Metropolitan Museum in New York, by the way. So Abdullah becomes the boss, and he rules all of Central Asia from Nishapur at this period. And believe it or not, this guy called for universal education. I mean, it couldn't have been clearer what he called for. I mean, find anyone else on the planet. You know, so, you know, this story is very rich, but it's not owned by anyone. And anyone who tries, any country within Central Asia, any country outside, whether Iran, you name it, this is a civilization we're talking about. And I think it will be a challenge to Iran to appreciate the specificity of this Central Asian world and culture. I think it's going to be a challenge. I expect that they're going to come at me hammer and tong. But, you know, Ferdowsi, you mentioned, you know, some of the big guys. He made his career entirely in the context of the Samanids of Bukhara. They were his patrons. You know, and I go through every one of them. Ghazali, well, you know, he's one of our guys over in the East. I think that the history is going to present a challenge to everyone, but if they're smart, they're going to look at the individual people and say, "My God, where does this wonderful spirit of inquiry come from?" You know, there were bookstores all over the region. I mean, we know the price of books. There were libraries. We have detailed account of the library in Bukhara in 1000 AD. We know the system for cataloging the books. You know, we know what was in each room of the library. You know, the Gurganch up in Khwarezm. You know, we know what they had in libraries. It's unbelievable seriousness. And the tragedy is that, of course, architecturally, they built in sun-dried brick. Had they built these great cities in stone, that they had stone, we'd all know about it. But unfortunately, it's all dissolved. it would be like Italy if Merv in 1250 was the biggest city in the world. Period. I mean, you go there today. I've spent a lot of time there. I know it well. But, you know, you have to have a pretty rich imagination to capture that. And so architecturally, things have vanished. But in terms of paper, they wrote on paper and parchment. And I go through this in the text. Of the works of Biruni, I think only, I don't remember the numbers, but 12 out of 127 exist in any form. And of these, only three have been issued in authoritative editions in Arabic, let alone translated. I mean, we are talking, this whole book of mine is based on fragments of what actually was. And if you instead conceive, I mean, we know the titles of hundreds of lost treatises. And if you imagine a world in which these were all available, being copied out like mad, sold in bookstores all over the place, there were book auctions, you know, when you add that all up together, you come up with something pretty extraordinary.
Fred, thank you. I think we've reached the end of our allotted time, but thank you for a tour de force of a book and a presentation.
Thank you.